21st. This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Folk Runyon. And tonight, our very special guest is the British magician and author, Jake Stratton Kent. Now, Jake has been studying and practicing magic, especially goetic magic, in England since 1972. He is the author of numerous books on the subject and is most noted for his efforts to rehabilitate the reputation of the goetic magical process. That's the evocation of spirits alleged to be demonic by methods that are also alleged to be black magic. Now, Jake holds that these so-called demons are or were originally pagan divinities or honored heroes and sages of earlier times, and that the magicians who evoked them were the original shamans of our own European ancestral heritage. Now, his theories and his practical work have made him a controversial figure in the present occult revival, but his impressive scholarship and talents have kept him well ahead of his critics. Now, we are honored to have him join us on the Hermetic Hour. I'm going to ask now to see if we have him in. Jake, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, excellent. Now, I'd like to start off here after my brief introduction. And, you know, tell us how you got started on this this goetic path and share some of your earlier magical experiences with us, if you will.
Well, I guess about 1972, week one, I got a hold of a magical manual, Paul Hewson's Mastering Witchcraft, and started working practically straight away. It seems sensible to learn by experience simultaneously. And got a hold of Idris Shah's Grimoire compilation, was conjuring Lucifuge, Rothengarli fairly soon afterwards. It's been a learning process and a practical process from day one. And yeah, that's pretty much where I started, out in the sticks, in a log cabin conjuring spirits.
Was the book that got you started Paul Hewson's Mastering Witchcraft?
That was my first ever practical manual, yeah.
Yeah, he actually, Paul Hewson actually had the Enochian, from Ethiopian Enoch, he had those fallen angels in his witchcraft system, if you recall. Did that lead you from there into the Lesser Key of Solomon?
Yeah, pretty quickly. Yeah, I got into sort of Solomonic magic through, you know, compilations like Idris Sharp. And yeah, I guess you could say Hewson prepared me for the idea that, you know, the devils were the witches' gods. And I've always been fairly receptive to, you know, that interpretation of things. And you can find it in the grimoires. Yeah.
Well, I remember
it says,
that,
you know, this demon also goes to sabbats and does things with witches.
Paul Hewson had Basago, who was right, you know, in the beginning of the Goetia. He had those as one of his spirits, and I know that that is connected to the Lesser Key of Solomon. So when you got started with doing the Lesser Key,
I've always been more a grimoire in verum kind of guy, to be honest.
Oh, were you Grimoire Verum? Yeah, you were using that as early as 1972?
That end of the spectrum much more. Yeah, that and the Grand Grimoire, where you get Lucifuge, Rothengarli. They're a similar part of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some major divergences from to the Lesser Key of Solomon in the way it approaches things. And also the instrumentum's a lot clearer.
Yeah. I've seen pictures of some of your magical equipment from those days, and it's very nostalgic, because I guess when we got started we all wanted to make the equipment similar to the way that it's illustrated in the Key of Solomon, in the Greater Key.
Mm-hmm.
You went through all of that with the black handle knife and the white handle knife and all of that, uh, that That
yeah,
material,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Grimoire and Barum's very similar. It's more similar to the Greater Key in a lot of ways. It's just got a spirit catalogue attached.
You know, as I said in the list of questions that I sent you, I've been presently working my way through your two-volume Geo Sophia, The Argo of Magic, and I had a question that I wanted to ask you regarding your Geography of Hades that you have in there. And it seems that, you're placing all of the traditional Orphic afterlife experiences in the underworld rather than the celestial zodiac. Now, is this because of the primitive concept, and possibly pre-Homeric, I said, that the night sky was also the realm beneath the horizon during the day? Or if not, do you hold that all souls must descend, and that even Elysium lies beneath the surface? And so, would you comment on that?
Well, I try and chart the primitive and the classical, and see the relation between them. And yeah, in the classical period, they're definitely starting to map the Hades out in the sky, but I think there are much earlier precursors of that idea. And so underworld, afterlife, and starry heaven seem to be connected in all sorts of ways. And like, there are plenty of very chthonic deities, you know, like the constellation Virgo, is Demeter or Persephone, an underworld goddess, but you know, there she is in the heavens. And Shem Hazai in the Enochian text, in the Enochian Apocalypse is, he's hung up in chains, but not in the underworld. Up in the sky is constellation Orion. So the two, you know, overlap, and in a kind of mythic language, you can't really distinguish or expect the borders to be too clear between underworld and starry heaven. I hope kind of sense.
Well, yeah, it does, because, of course, in the Kabbalah, we sort of have this concept that you enter the higher realms by first going through the lower realms, in other words, the subconscious, and the subconscious is the path to the higher realms, I think that probably goes back to the idea that the underworld, the geography of the underworld, and after a while, as we know, it got transplanted into the zodiac, and the heroes and the divinities all got, and then, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with Macrobius and his commentary on Scipio's dream, and
and material like that, yeah.
Yeah, and the Mithriatic ladder and the whole business. So I'm very partial to the idea of going down through the underworld and making it. And well, even Swedenborg said that heaven and hell were right. The hell was right next door to heaven. So maybe he was onto something there. What I'd like to ask though with you is in rehabilitating the Galatia on a Grecian mode, because that's where it starts. You reminded us several times in the Geo Sophia books that the ghost, is that the way you pronounce it, the old Greek sorcerer?
Oh, my classical languages are rubbish, but something like goes, I think it's a fairly hard word, and plural goetes or goetes and singular goes, yeah. This is the individual that Galicia is named after, is the magician, rather than the other way around. You know, usually it's the art, you know, it gives a name to the artist, but with Galicia it's the other way around. The artist gives a name to the art. The goer does Galicia.
Yeah, as, you know, kind of an analogy, the old mythological, whoever it was defining the astrological correspondences, they were putting all of these heroes that that were once in the underworld or that are putting them up in the sky, and then eventually the River Leif and all of these geography of Hades ended up being up in the sky too.
There's a journey on the Milky Way intersecting with the zodiac, interpreted as the rivers of the underworld. That's exactly how I see it. Yeah.
So
and
here again,
that's expressed in Chaldean terms. It also turns up in Germanic folklore. I suspect it's prehistoric rather than classical, but it certainly emerges again in the classical period.
Right. Now, one of the things I'm kind of curious about, you obviously worked the Lesser Key of Solomon, and you found the same kind of faults with it that we found with it. Tormenting the spirits just doesn't seem to be a very good idea, especially.
Grimorian Verum's much more spirit friendly. It works through spirit through an intermediary system rather than compulsion. You become familiar with some of the superior spirits. You cultivate a relationship with some of the superior spirits so that you can then ask of the, in a more pleasant way, for favors from their subordinates. This is much closer to the idea of a pact than the theologian doing his exorcism. It's actually much closer to witchcraft.
Oh, yeah. We certainly did that with Baal and Astaroth because they were, according to, Richard Cavendish was the one that first put me onto that, was that they were obviously the old Canaanite gods, Baal and Astarte. And we certainly apologized to them and had an official apology for summoning him up with the way the Goetia does it. Were you able to acquaint any of the Goetic spirits in the Lesser Key with any Greek entities?
Well, I think Astaroth's a case in point. I think it's a biblical name being applied to a classical deity, like, for instance, Artemis of Ephesia or Diana of the Ephesians, as it became in the Roman period. Yeah, it's a natural biblical figure for opponents to draw on is Astaroth. And Baal, there's a very similar thing going on in the solar pantheism of the classical and Hellenistic period. Syrian and Chaldean ideas are very strong, but Baal was still a very common name. And so they could find a biblical analogue for that, which was historic rather than contemporary. But it's the contemporary forms, I think, were shaping it.
Yeah.
There are other biblical names. I suspect that Myrma may be connected to Rimmon because it is an alternative pronunciation in the region. Bifrons is a title of Janus, and there's a fair few others. I think some have possibly been twisted, though. I don't think that Balaam necessarily was spelled that way originally. There's some wildly differing spellings of it. It may not represent an Old Testament prophet at all. It's really the idea of the spirits, spirits of the air, often collected into the lunar mansions or the solar decans. As a hierarchy, you can find that in classical philosophers, theurgists like Ian Blickus, who's almost the grandfather of spirit hierarchies in the grimoires. And it's more the conception of demons that's similar than individual cases most of the time.
The
church sees them.
Even
though they're similar names, they're not interpreted the same way as the church sees them. Spirits have real powers rather than illusory powers. They're autonomous as long as you know the ritual, they will turn up. They don't need God's permission on that occasion to come and tempt you, which is the way the church describes it. It's a completely different conception, and it's much closer to the old pagan conception or the folkloric interpretation of Orthodox ideas. Sorry, I'm on a bit there.
You in the first volume of the Geosophia, you have an extensive chapter on the Greek sibyls, and And you have icons of all of them that you mentioned. I'm wondering, are you going to at some point give us a grimoire for conjuring these sigils? I mean these sibyls. I mean sigils for the sibyls.
There are such things in the grimoire literature, because the seven sisters, seven fairy sisters, are intimately connected with the Sibyl mythology. Turn up in a lot of grimoires. It used to be thought that her occurrence in the grimoire in Verum was a frivolous exception. It's not. The thing goes back at least to the Hygromantia, and in my opinion, even further to the Queen of Sheba in the Testament of Solomon, who is called the Wise Sibyl in at least some of the manuscripts. So the Sibyl figure is around. It's a huge figure in the grimoire literature, and there's hostile takes on it where they try and use the compulsion, but that doesn't seem to be the original form at all. Sibyl takes a particular form; others may take other forms.
Yeah.
They're
oracular, so what better? There certainly are good ones to conjure up, because they were oracular to begin with. That's why people visited them back when they were supposedly alive, was to learn to get as a form of divination. Let them divine and answer the question. And so they certainly would be. I would think it would be a very good spirit subject for conjuration. And so what?
We used to see kings in the grimoires. This is one of the queens.
What?
Seven sibyls is traditional. There's groups of 10 and 12, but you can equally appear as a singular figure. And I'm just trying to nudge a bit more interest in that area, and let people interpret it for themselves rather than produce a grimoire, although it's a great idea.
One of the things that I'm noticing going through your Argo of Magic books is at times I think I'm reading Robert Graves. Would you say you're influenced by him? Because I just have a feeling like when I'm reading, I know you're writing it, but it feels like, oh my gosh, it feels like I'm reading The White Goddess again,
only turned on its head substantially.
You are quite familiar with Robert Graves, I take it.
I was influenced by him early on. I mean, I've been at this a long time, but for me, that whole approach to things was knocked on its head by Ronald Hutton's Triumph of the Moon, which kind of pulled the rug from under me intellectually, probably a lot of other people too. It was like, oh, right, this interpretation of mythology and everything I've got is actually complete bunkum. So where do I start? And I started by going back to Goetia as, the most primitive end of the Western magical tradition, and which von Hutten himself conceded is a legitimate historical tradition to be claiming, rather than the one the witches actually were. We've got a Neolithic religion going. There's the tradition of ritual magic and Goetia. So in order to get somewhere to stand on intellectually again, it's Goetia I went to and ended up writing an encyclopedia. It is an answer to Graves rather than going with him.
Graves is very, very influential on Roy Bowers, who used to write under the name of, he's passed away, but he used to write under the name of Robert Cochrane, I believe, over there.
I don't really hold with the Margaret Murray thesis and so on at all. It was massively influential, and perhaps it was a useful creation myth once upon a time. But I think we're strong enough to go for real history now.
Recently, we've been covering some of Gerald Gardner's original writings, High Magic Fade, and of course, one of the things that we were stressing in our coverage of High Magic Fade was that Gardner started off as a Solomonic ceremonial magician and blended that into his idea of witchcraft. Have you had any background with any work with the Gardnerian people?
Yeah, I'm quite sympathetic with Gerald Gardner. It might be unfashionable, but I think a lot of the threads he wove into the shadows, like Solomonic magic and elements of Aleister Crowley, are good places for people to build on rather than weed out. You know, let's have more grimoiric magic and maybe investigate a bit of this Thelma stuff as well. I think the guy did good. And for me, I've gradually moved more away from the Golden Dawn Crowley end of things and more towards the grimoires. And particularly the Grimoire and Verum, and that is actually the practical base of pretty much everything I do. And I found it's rich, flexible, versatile. I work with the same family of spirits, essentially, the same liturgical structure. It's actually very versatile rather than limiting. It's a language that you can use rather than a framework that you're stuck in.
One of your other interviews that I looked at online, you were suggesting that the Golden Dawn and related magical orders were really not very conducive to people that are actually want to get into ceremonial magic, and because they're too restrictive and their ideas or whatever. And I tend to agree with you there. Even though I'm partial to Golden Dawn as a historical phenomenon, and I did the Golden Dawn Cipher manuscript book and all of that with Bob Gilbert. But even so, I agree with you that they are kind of inhibiting to the magician who needs to be able to find his own way and experiment himself. Would you say though that the Solomonic magic idea is influenced perhaps too much by the Golden Dawn and by masonry? What are your feelings on that?
Well, the grimoire seems to have an implicit idea that you ought to be working alone or with a couple of companions. Even grand Solomonic ceremonial, it's a handful of people, and probably a mentor and students, but more often working alone or a couple, a seer and a conjurer working together. They're small and they just get on with it. They don't have initiation ceremonies and so on. The work itself, you could say, is initiatory if you're that active. For me, certainly, there's an internal mystery in the ritual patterns that I work, which is ultimately initiatory. I'm dealing with a mythological hierarchy, a pantheon. I mean, how could it be anything else but, in some way, a mystery? So I've got nothing against lodges. The good old-fashioned Masonic lodges, particularly, are fairly democratic. You're not worshipful master for life in that. I can see how it could be useful. But it can also be an impediment. Way too many activities that aren't just getting down to doing magic. I think we need a bit of a rethink.
Yeah, one of the things I'm really curious about is, I had it in one of our questions here, and I said one of the challenges I first encountered in working Goetia, and I started back in 1969 with a Goetia of Solomon's Lesser Key. And that's how to bring the spirit to visible appearance in the triangle. And I settled on using a dark mirror in the triangle, and I found that worked well in conjunction with a hypnotic trance state in which I could channel the spirit. I also experimented myself with placing the receiver, sometimes myself, in the triangle itself and letting him or her become the horse of the spirit, voodoo style. Now, this also worked, and Gardner used it in that method in High Magic's Aid, as you may recall. Now, without asking you, I don't want to ask you to reveal any secrets you might have on achieving trance states, but could you tell us what you use for spiritus focus and or conjuration device? In other words, how do you bring them to visible appearance?
Well, there's a variety of methods in the Grimoire and Beaumont further afield. I know what you're saying about, you know, you're putting somebody in the triangle. I have worked with induction and possession states, although the triangle is not part of the Grimoire and Beaumont apparatus. But it really comes down to the scrying techniques, which are represented here and there in the Grimoire and Beaumont, or the magician seeing a spirit appear outside the circle, which in the papyri is referred to as direct vision, of working without a scryer. But so those two strands have always been known, the Grimoire scrying or
spirit. Do you want to do it like Benvenuto Cellini and just produce a lot of smoke, or have the four smoke pots around the circle and produce smoke all the way around the circle and see how many of them
I've tried all that, but ultimately I find it's the direct vision experience, which is very active, you know, rather than passive as a seer might be. The invocations, the performance of the ritual, heightens my awareness. I'm not particularly psychic in day to day life, but in ritual I reach a state where I can see and communicate with spirits much, much more readily. And as I say, it's a very active, even a very intense state rather than a passive one. Trances, you know, the other end of the spectrum may be appropriate to a seer, but not to a conjurer. For me, it's like I'm bringing the astral to me rather than going to the astral. Magical space, ritual space is also mythological space. You know, the role of the intermediary is a mythological role as well as a ritual role. You know, mythology doesn't work without some kind of go-between, who's usually either a trickster, a vice-regent, or maybe a marshal of heaven. And intermediary figure is vitally important in Grimoire and Beaumont. It's very explicit. This is how it works. You go through Skirlin. I mean, the Grand Grimoire, it's more Lucifuge Rofficali, but the roles are the same. Buried in what's missing from the Galatia, but present in some related texts, is an upper hierarchy, Oriens, Paimon, Amaimon, again, and above them, Lucifer, Beelzebuth, Satan, is Lucifer, Beelzebuth, Astaroth in Grimoire and Beaumont, another strand of the family. Oriens, particularly, Skirlin or Syrac, whatever he's been called at the time, is the main intermediary figure. He's the king of the East. Well, he can make the other kings appear because he's the chief of the kings as well as the lower spirit. So you can break down all the complex intermediary stages and just keep going to Orient to get stuff done. You know, which is how the Grimoire and Beaumont does it. Got one intermediary.
Well, the Grimoire and Beaumont has a section The Grimoire and Beaumont has a section on Solomon's Mirror.
Solomon's Mirror. I've employed mirror magic, having a seer present, and ended up doing automatic writing instead because the mirror just wasn't producing the results. You've got to think on your feet. I've often a couple of divination methods into working with me rather than just one, because you know, you've got to be adaptable. It can't all be scripted at all.
Well, Paul Lusson said just when you reach the climax of your conjuration, blow all your candles out and let the spirit come in the dark. And that was his idea. I've tried that and they do, but you know, a dark surface, complete darkness, it's it's almost like visualizing with your eyes closed, which of course is part of the, you know, part of what we train to do.
All the timing given in the Geshe of Solomon is daylight. Yeah, you know, only Marquises appear in the evening. All the other spirits are diurnal according to that timing. But again, the French grimoires, which I tend to prefer, it's completely the reverse. The spirit, you know, Grand Grimoire specifies invoking them at night, in the planetary hour appropriate to the day, but during the night. So, whether darkness or light is appropriate is completely relative to the manual you're working with. It's wholehearted involvement in ritual that produces the results. I think getting down and doing a 3-hour ceremony, you are going to enter a mythological state and start and experience an interrelationship with an entity. You know, there's nothing particularly peculiar about that happening. The human psyche is kind of built that way. You want to be scientific about that.
Yeah, I note that you mentioned in your book several times that we should do cross-cultural studies on African methods, and I certainly agree with that because Voodoo, you know, in Voodoo, which we properly call Voodoo, those veves that they have, those signatures of the Oguns, are very, very similar to ours. To our sigils in the Lamegaton, they're very similar, and I was much more aware of this, and based upon that, the whole idea of letting the of having a receiver actually become the horse of the gods, so to speak, as in Voodoo. I know that, as I said earlier, that we experimented with sitting the receiver in the triangle and letting the receiver become the channel for the spirit. Have you ever done anything like that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, as I say, Grimoire Inferum doesn't use a triangle, but in various other setups, I've done similar things. So when I was more involved in Slavonic ritual, we had a ritual involving an enthroned priestess facing the congregation, including an invoking priest, which was taken into states which were ultimately possession states. So I had that experience, but in that context, we didn't really have a name for the various different entities that might appear. It was just like, this is the spirit of the astrological conditions. Once I started switching over to Geisha, I had a good idea who was going to turn up when I was doing stuff like that. You know, they had names, they had personalities, possession states. I've worked with quite extensively. But the direct vision method working solo is the classic approach. So I'm equally happy with that. And it's something you can do by yourself. You know, you don't have to have a whole group around you and a big temple space dedicated. You can just wander off into the countryside with your traveling conjuring kit and do it when you feel like it. So get the solo. Seers are good, and possession work is also good. They're fascinating experiences, and they can take Western magicians out of their comfort zone very, very quickly. You've got this idea that it's just some subconscious visualization you're doing, and then it starts having a conversation with you, and you've got to figure out what it wants before it will go away. Which in one case was roses, bottles of wine, and nice comfortable seats, stuff like that. I mean, rather than threatening with a sword, it's just, challenging. Yeah. It's a lady. Treat it like one.
Has anyone ever asked you to do an exorcism?
Oh, yeah, I've done exorcisms. My method's a bit old-fashioned because, as I say, I have ongoing relationships with the spirits of the grimoire rather than conjure them up to do something and never have anything to do with them again. It's an ongoing relationship, so I've got go-to guys who handle my immediate magical defences. I'm not likely to get a random nasty spirit arriving here. There's too many of my own living here already. But you can also employ one of your big, meaty spirits to tell a ghost to bugger off from somebody else's house. If it's not receptive to a gentler approach. There are more thought, being friendly with demons is a good way of getting rid of lesser spooks.
Yeah. I had to do one recently, the reason why the particular girl, had, when she was a teenager, she had gotten into some goetic circle.
Unfortunately, it can be a real mess.
That's right, and she got and she picked one of the most what I think is one of the most dangerous ones in the Galatia to experiment with, and it stayed with her for a long, long time, and finally in her 30s she decided she had enough and she wanted to get rid of it, and so we did, and when we finally found out what it was, I asked the gal that was serving for us, and I said, "Have you got a $20 bill?" And she reached in her purse and pulled out the $20 bill, and I burned the $20 bill in the thurible as a gift to the spirit, because I don't care, even if it is an evil spirit, even if we are doing an exorcism, we're still going to honor it. We still are going to try to reason with it rather than threaten it.
If it's a genuine demon, it's like an evolved entity in its own right, rather than some sort of decomposing ghost, which can be quite malicious. The demons are usually fairly evolved and often test you rather than seeking to hurt you. That's my experience.
Well, what do you think about... what do you think about this tormenting the spirit by the curse of chains and all that sort of business? I was so upset with that idea that I even left it out of our book on Solomonic magic. I wouldn't even put it in there.
I've got no time for that sort of thing. I'm not saying that all the spirits are sweetness and light, and that you might not have to one day, as I say, think on your feet and deal with a situation. Yeah. But being set up for it, that's the frame of mind of people who are basically trying to say, it's not me doing black magic, it's the spirit. Yeah. That's not really the point of view you see in the Grimoire in Verum at all. It talks about becoming familiar with the spirit, becoming a good, more closely acquainted with them, getting their favor, of one of the superiors. And then to the deputies working with the subordinates. It's a much preferable process, really. And if things do turn nasty, well, you should be a resourceful magician. But going and expecting it to be nasty and mistreating the spirits as routine, it's just stupid. As well as not politically correct or whatever. I mean, that's neither here nor there. It's not necessary. And the Grimoires do fairly often say, look, there's these other people who do magic, the witches, and these spirits are really theirs. You can find passages like that in Weir's text, which precedes the Goetia. There's versions of the Grimoire Fenorius which say, oh yeah, this spirit goes to Sabbats and has a wonderful time, but here they are trying to compel it, and it's obviously possible to have another kind of relationship within the same general tradition.
Yes, I agree. And would you want to kind of give us your advice to people starting out in this work? Because a lot of our listeners are new to our hermetic tradition and to ceremonial magic, and you're certainly one of the world's experts on the subject, and so what would you be your advice to young
people? Sure.
Well, what sort of advice would you give to young people starting out in this tradition?
Well, you know, not to have too black and white an idea of the spirit world for a start, that it's, you know, divided into, you know, good and evil, because, you know, the traditional law doesn't see it like that, right? Like that at all. It's a better idea to understand the demons as so-called as elemental spirits, and to look at some of the living traditions like Kimbanda and Voodoo, and not sensationalized versions of them, to try and revivify what's left of traditional Western magic, because it's still in a state of revival. There are no real experts. You know, there's people who've got accumulated experience, but we are still in the process of regenerating Western magic. And the spirits have been involved in it a lot longer than we have. So I treat them with respect.
Along that line, talking about young people and what they're into and what they're interested in, I'm sure you've run into a number of people asking you, and they ask me, what about the Necronomicon? We even did a satirical little poem on that got to be that went viral. But
I remember coming across it.
What?
I have come across your poem, actually, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But
there you go, Necronomicon
doesn't really appeal.
We had a lot of fun with that one. What seems to have happened is that so many people, young people especially, have wanted there to be a Necronomicon, and wanted that they've actually, in a sense, they kind of reified it. And so, in a way, these entities seem to have acquired some kind of psycho spiritual reality. I think that in a way,
I don't know how much noise to signal there is. But there are chunks of authentic Babylonian magic and what have you mixed up in Necronomicon mythos that's evolved, but how much noise to signal there is in what people get from the spirit is another matter. I think there are more clear-cut systems that we could work with. The spirits can actually do us some good rather than just scare the willies out of us.
Yeah, there is a key of Solomon, a lesser key of Megaton, but there ain't no Necronomicon of that, we have no doubt. As I say, I've run into several people who really scared themselves with that, the paperback version and the leather-bound one that preceded it. So I suppose we're going to have to, at some point, we're going to have to be able to exorcise Cthulhu. The only one I found that the only one effective magical Necronomicon I found was the one that my friend Lynn Carter came up with, which he attributed to John Dee and called it the John Dee translation. That one, Carter was a pretty good occultist, and he made a grimoire out of it that actually seems like it might work, but we haven't had to do an exorcism on it yet. Anyway, you have a number of books, and right now you've got a book out on the Grand Grimoire. I mean, not the Grand Grimoire, the Grimorum Verum. You have your own version of Grimorum Verum, right?
Well, it's my reconstruction, which it doesn't take too many liberties with the text, really. There is a family of texts, and familiarizing yourself with the variants, something very coherent comes out of and. Of the various Solomonic works, it's the most compact, and the most spirit friendly. But I felt it needed some elucidation from a different angle to Joseph Peterson's critical edition, which is also ex- extremely useful. But, yeah, the demons, as I understand them, aren't related to the modern conception of cliff off and Lovecraftian monsters and stuff like that. Yeah, magical tradition, spirits are simply like autonomous beings with whom you can have a relationship and get stuff done. They're not damned spirits, which is the problem with the cliff off. It is an idea that involves like their ultimate destruction as evil. They're locked away in some dungeon dimension most of the time. They don't resemble the Grimmar spirits, even though some of them share the same names. It's a completely different interpretation of things.
Well, we know that the Lesser Key of Solomon. We know that the underworld that they're referring to in the Lesser Key of Solomon is a Dante-esque Greco-Christian Tartarus, basically, and it, which was adopted by the Christian theologians. And we know that, so that makes the spirits down there much less terrifying than the Cliffoth. And we also know that the Cliffoth, when the descriptions of the spirits in the Cliffoth, including those we know and love, are really horrible. My friend and colleague Steve Sabdo, as you may know, back about 20 years ago, he rented a warehouse in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and in the middle of summer, he and his rock and roll band boys went in there, and then they set up and they did Goetia in there at 110 degrees in the shade they got results. But the trouble is, Steve was raised in a Jewish home, and so he put all his Goetia entities, as far as he was concerned, were in the Cliffoth. So when he got them, and they got them, they got them, they pushed themselves until they got them. And they all looked like gargoyles, and Steve said that all they got from all of this was several notebooks full of totally unprintable stuff that they couldn't publish because according to him, it was really terrible stuff. And we don't want would you. I don't think that in the Grimorum Verum, I don't think those spirits are consigned to the Cliffoth, are they? I don't read it that way.
No, it's a completely different idea. The Cliffoth really originate in a particularly pessimistic stage of Jewish philosophy. They happen to share some similar names with spirits of old traditions. Samael is a case in point, but you find this demonization or friendlier interpretations of the same spirit in a spectrum of literature. Asmodeus in some Jewish traditions, he's not even in hell. He never goes there. Most of the demons of the Goetic texts are considered to be spirits of the air. Region we've got to travel through when we start our journey into the celestial underworld, so to speak. The spirits of the air are the ones that might give us trouble, or the ones that might help us. Lucifer and Satan, both called Prince of the Powers of the Air. Asmodeus, in a lot of Jewish tradition, is a friendly fellow. Perfectly amiable.
Well, part of that, I think that we can blame part of that on the Golden Dawn, because Mathers was very influenced by the Zohar
Uriah particularly,
and so they ended up having a Cliffoth in the Golden Dawn, and so I think that's where some of our Goetic magicians decided that that's where the spirits were. And
it's a recent innovation. It doesn't belong in the Grimoires at all, or in folk magic. There's nothing similar. Yes, they've been superimposed on the magical tradition. They shouldn't really blur how we see Goetia. But unfortunately, it has done in popular imagination.
So we can say that the idea of taking that underworld, that classic Greek underworld, which carried on through to Roman times and even carried through to the Christian tradition with Dante and all, that in turn got translated into the Zodiac. So I think maybe we can say that, hey, the underworld ain't that bad. I mean, it's we can look at it that way. As we said in the beginning of the show here, you gotta go down below to get up above, and that puts a whole different approach on this fallen angel thing and the so-called evil spirits of the Goetia. Would you agree with that?
Well, definitely. I consider the spirits I work with essentially my co-workers. I don't have a magical order. I've got pact with about 40 spirits. If I'm doing herbal work, then the spirits responsible for herbal law, who I will actually be interacting with while I'm working with the pestle and mortar. For me, it's an ongoing relationship with essentially individuals who have mythological characteristics that you can find in folklore, in not just in Greek mythology. The Western tradition, there's been a large infusion of Germanic culture as well. The four kings of the Grimoires, you can trace it in classical, but you can also trace it in Germanic folklore, and the two fused together around the time of Agrippa. This is almost the renaissance of the second synthesis, you might say. But Western magic is a rich tradition, and the spirits have been involved in it a lot longer than we have.
It's a rich tradition and a great adventure. And you and I have both said at different times in different ways that what we are now is, we are the urban shamans, the civilized urban shamans, and we're the ones that are the modern counterparts of the old ghosts from back in the days of ancient Greece, even before Homer, and we're their modern counterparts.
We are on a practical level, we do the same job, but we're also in a way guardians of the same tradition in the modern era, and we've got to adapt it to these times while being respectful of it, because it is a rich tradition. It's culturally important, and it stands on equal standing with any of the great world religions, and all lesser traditions, on a more regional level. Western magic is culturally significant. Academics have been realizing that for a long time, how important it is. Our knowledge of Greek pharmacology has been massively improved by translating the Greek magical papyri. This stuff is significant. It's something to be proud of and to get involved in as a vocation, rather than I'll just conjure a spirit to get what I want now and then be rude to him. Which is a fairly farcical, two-dimensional approach to it. I mean, there's no rational explanation for why a spirit would let you bully into teaching you another language. With no kind of transaction involved. It's just not very it's not philosophically satisfying to understand it that way.
Yeah. Well, Jake, we're just about to the end of the hour here, and I want to thank you so much for coming on, and I want to encourage all of our listeners to make use of your wonderful resources, your books, all of which are available in one form or another, I believe, on our Amazon. And At least it appears that most of them are. Do you have any new one coming out shortly that you'd like to tell us about that we can look forward to?
Well, I've been involved for a while with an overview of spirit catalogues from different grimoires and how they interrelate. Some of the identifications may be startling because the spellings have changed so much and gone down different avenues. But yeah, an overview of the spirit catalogues of most of the major grimoires has been on the cards for a while. So that's probably going to come to fruition in some form or another eventually. I'm not sure what else fall out of the woodwork in the meantime, because big projects tend to produce little spin-off projects, like a pamphlet about a particular spirit or whatever. That's the sort of thing in the near future,
right.
I think.
Good. Thank you so much for being with us, and we'll hope to have you on again, and I'm looking forward to reading more of your work, because as I say, I'm in the middle of the Argo of Magic, and that is absolutely. That'll keep me busy for another week or so, and then I'm going to get into your version of the Grimorum Verum, and that's next on my list. Thank you so much for being with us,
it's been a great pleasure, Clark.
Yeah, and we really appreciate what you're doing. Thanks again, and good magic.
And to you.